Hello and hi, welcome back to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And our guest now is award-winning science fiction legend David Gerald. He's won the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, the Bram Stoker Award, and he's known for writing episodes of a lot of the TV shows that we consider iconic. Star Trek, Babylon 5, Twilight Zone, Sliders, and so many more.
Don't forget Land of the Lost.
Land of the Lost. I loved that show as a kid.
Me too.
Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we are embarking upon the increase in celebrations of 50 years of Star Trek. And you wrote one of the most memorable episodes, I think, Tribbles, Trouble with Tribbles.
Well, it was a dirty job and somebody had to do it. You know.
That I think was the second Trek episode I ever saw. And I just kind of went, what? Furry popcorn?
I've never heard him described that way. That's funny.
Oh, it's just thinking of the Klingons munching on Tribbles, I just thought, popcorn. Furry popcorn. Whoa. So what for you was the most memorable about how long Star Trek has lasted, your involvement in it then, and your reflections on it now?
It'd be hard to pick out a single moment. I think I'd have to go with the affection and generosity of the cast. I'm in love with Nichelle Nichols. She is just so much fun to hang out with. D. Kelly was one of the nicest men I have ever met in the whole world. Just an absolute delight. Leonard Nimoy has, not just as Spock, but as an individual, had such enormous gravitas that, you know, you just felt you were with somebody who had a piece of the wisdom of the ages. And he really did. I mean, he was hardworking. He was focused. I have nothing but good things to say about Leonard. And of course, Bill Shatner, who is a workaholic. I mean, he had to memorize 60 pages of script a week. He had to be there every day, early in the morning for makeup. He was on camera more than any other actor. And I mean, that it was a killer schedule for him, but he was not only a workaholic, but he was always contributing suggestions to the director, to the lighting guy, to everybody. He said, you know, this would work. That will. The first time I was on the set, I watched him give, they were trying to set up the lighting for a key moment in Doomsday Machine. And he said, why don't you put a flag over the light so I can lower my head into shadow? And Mark Daniels, who's one of the great directors in television, said, well, seemed like a good idea at the time. And before he had finished the sentence, Jerry Finnerman, just a great DP, had already rigged the flag over the light and they did the shot. And we didn't have video monitors in those days. It was, you know, look through the lens. So I didn't see what it looked like till it showed up on the air. But I was watching that episode and I said, wow. And it just gave me a sense of the partnership on that soundstage, that there was such incredible morale. Everybody loved everybody. I mean, there were occasional disagreements about this or that or the other. But ultimately, I think that crew and that cast became one of the most amazing families. And I think that's part of the, I think that showed up in the show somehow. And that's part of why the fans love the actors so much, is because they sense that family.
It's interesting you say that, because as the years and the decades have fallen away, we get more and more of the books and the stories that paint a less than flattering picture of some of the people involved. Why do you think that might be? And do you think it's a question of, because there's not but so much left to talk about that people are looking for anything to talk about?
Look, I have some stories about Gene Roddenberry that are, you know, not complimentary. And the fact is, I go back to Gene gave us Star Trek. He was there. He fought for Star Trek. He was there the whole time. He made Star Trek happen. And you have to give him credit for that. If he was a great visionary, he was also, you know, if he had great virtues, he also had great flaws. So what we're getting, I think, is a more realistic picture that nobody is a hero all the time. We all have our failures and our flaws and our stumbles. What we're getting is that even within a family, there are disagreements, but there's still a family. You know, I've talked to Bill and a couple of the other actors about this very thing. And Bill is very conscious of the fact that he was so overworked, not just with his 60 pages of script and his long hours, but that as star of the show, he had to do a lot of interviews, et cetera, et cetera. The other actors would come in for 1 or 2 days and didn't have that same pressure on them. And I don't think they realized that Bill was in a much different situation they were. Bill didn't realize until years later that his focus on the show, he had somehow forgotten to be a good buddy to the other actors, and they had been hurt by it. You know, it happens. You get so focused on the job that you forget to take care of family. But I think Bill was very candid about that in his own book. But it doesn't mean that there isn't a warm affection. I mean, I've seen Bill and Leonard get together on stage at a convention. And, I mean, you'd think these were two guys who had been married for 30 years. And, in effect, they were. Right. Because they spent more time with each other during those 3 years the show was in production than they spent with their own families. And then with the movies, each one was a reunion of the family. So I think if there had really been real tension, people would have refused to come back for those first few movies.
And to that point, for the Ben Bella book, Boarding the Enterprise, I've got a copy of the 2006 edition and also a copy mm-hmm. of the 2016. And your foreword...
Oh, then you're way ahead of me because I haven't seen the 2016 issue yet.
Well, the only difference that I've been able to find is in your foreword. In the mm-hmm. 2006 edition, you talk about basically Star Trek's unfulfilled potential, which in some ways is an extension of what you had written in the world of Star Trek in the last yeah. section of that book. And for 2016, it's a much more celebratory approach for the 50th anniversary. Can yeah. you talk
Did they
about...
leave the 2006 intro in the book too?
They did not.
Oh, what a shame. Okay, well, now people are just going to have to buy both editions.
Right.
That it is more celebratory because we do want to celebrate 50 years. And four members of the original cast are still with us. We still have Dorothy Fontana and myself. We just lost George Clayton Johnson. Harlan is still around. Some of the behind the scenes people are still around, and it's kind of nice to be able to say, look at the effect we have had. Look at it. It wasn't just a TV show. We did something. We made a difference. And, you know, you do that for your 50th anniversary of anything. You take a moment to say, okay, we done good.
So talk about putting together the book, Boarding the Enterprise, because it's a vast, I guess, as Trek was, diverse look at Star Trek and its influences at the time.
Well, I give a lot of credit to Bob Sawyer and to Ben Bella for putting the book together because I did not have as much time as I wanted, but we were able to gather a very diverse and very intelligent group of people to write articles and essays about Trek that I think even today, 50 years, 50 years after the original show, this this bit of hindsight allows us to understand not just the inner workings of Trek, but the impact of Trek with a much broader perspective. And I'm very proud of the people who we got to contribute. I think they did such a great job.
There are some wonderful essays, and the one essay that really impacted me and caused me to go back and look at some old episodes is the one, and I can't remember the title, but the author looks at American interventionism in the 60s and how it was reflected in various episodes.
I might be blanking out, but I think that sounds like David Brin.
No, I don't think it was Brin, actually.
Okay. All right.
But clearly I've blanked as well, but he
I'm having a senior moment or a blonde moment.
But he gets into discussion about especially a Spectre of the Gun and how that was an interpretation of interventionist policy and a repudiation of the American myth of the Western frontier. And it's interesting that even 50 years on, that those conversations are still relevant.
What happened, I'm a history buff, particularly the 19th and 20th centuries, and you look at what happened post-World War II, is this country developed a specific kind of paranoia that we could never allow ourselves to be attacked again. And that has led us into some unfortunate military adventures, and it has given us a... we have bought into a particular kind of we have to be the biggest badass on the block. And while I certainly can't fault the commitment to never being attacked again, I think that is the best commitment of all. I think some of the decisions made in service of that vision have been kind of stupid. And so you look at Spectre of the Gun, you look at Star Trek as a commentary on the political process, and you see that Star Trek was a very ambitious a very ambitious educational view of let's talk about what we stand for. It's Star Trek was always a way to examine ideas separate from the specifics, so that we could look at the philosophy, the underlying philosophy, without bogging down in arguments about details. And I think, you know, that's all you can do in an hour-long TV show.
So given that, and one of the hallmarks that has made Star Trek so famous was that it was a format that allowed Roddenberry and the writers to examine contemporary American situations in a format that could get onto the air, you know, because it was in many ways allegory. In today's television especially, there isn't that fear. There's so many outlets that allow producers, writers, and creators to express exactly what they're talking about and very directly. So given that the landscape has changed, where does Star Trek now fit into that, especially with CBS announcing a new series?
Well, I have to go back to something that Roddenberry would say in story meetings. We would bring in writers on Next Gen, and he would give the same very inspiring speech to all of them. He would say, tell me the story that sticks in your craw that nobody else will let you write, and which was a great speech. And if Roddenberry had been the executive he imagined himself to be, Star Trek Next Gen would have been an incredible show. The reason it didn't end up as good as Gene had promised is a long story, which I'm not going to go into here.
But just to let you know, I've seen Chaos on the Bridge.
Okay, well, that's the teeniest, tiniest tip of the iceberg.
Right,
okay, it was much more than that. But Gene had the skill of inspiring writers to do the very best. But he would say, tell me that story that needs to be told. And writers would get inspired and go off and do and be ambitious. And the original Star Trek inspired ambition. I mean, you look at the episodes, all the episodes the fans love the most, Amok Time, Balance of Terror, Corbomite Maneuver, Doomsday Machine, Tribbles, City on the Edge of Forever, the Journey to Babel. You look at all these great episodes, and you can see that there is genuine ambition in the storytelling. It's like, I'm going to reach for something that no other TV show can do. And I think that's still appropriate for Star Trek. It's still appropriate for any good show, like West Wing, to take on big challenges. And so I would encourage Nicholas Meyer and Brian Fuller to take Star Trek into that same direction. What's the most dangerous stories we can tell? And there's still a lot of big issues that need to be addressed that Trek never came near before. My biggest complaint about Next Generation and the shows that followed was they weren't ambitious enough.
Do you think CBS will give this new series and its new leaders a chance to go that dangerous route?
I have no information on their thinking, so I can't say anything yay or nay. They don't call me and say, "Here's what we're planning." So I really can't say.
Do you hope that they will?
I hope that they will do the very best Star Trek ever, because that's what the fans deserve. The fans are the ones who've kept the show alive for 50 years. The success of Star Trek is entirely because of the fans' enthusiasm for the series. And so I think the fans deserve the very best show that anybody can make. I know Nick Myers is a big Star Trek fan. I have heard that Brian Fuller is. So my guess is that if they're coming from that particular place of enthusiasm, they'll probably do a good job. I'm looking forward to seeing what they can do.
If you could give them any bit of advice for making the best Star Trek they possibly could, beyond what you just said, which is write the story that you've got to write, what would you suggest?
I'd give them my phone number.
And you haven't already?
They haven't returned my phone call. My advice would be to bring in either myself or Dorothy Fontana, so that they have somebody there who was part of the original series and can give them that perspective, that Trek needs to what the fans want. I've seen this from reading their comments everywhere on the internet and elsewhere. What the fans really want is a return to the spirit of the original series. And I believe that somebody who sat in with a lot of meetings with Gene Roddenberry is probably a person who could give them that perspective of what it was that Gene said that inspired so many writers to be so ambitious. I think what has happened in a lot of the spin-offs has been people imposing their own view of what they think Star Trek should be. And the truth is, Star Trek works best when you go back to what Gene Roddenberry wanted it to be and Gene L. Coon.
Where do you think well, I'll tell you what I think my concern is that now Star Trek has become a big money-making venture.
It's become a
And
franchise, yeah.
from a business standpoint, are they willing to do something that jeopardizes that cash replicator?
Well, my experience on Next Generation is that one of the executives from the studio who had previously written a memo on how bold and aggressive Star Trek could be ended up being one of the people who said, "Well, we have to not offend anybody because we don't want to risk hurting the franchise." And the minute they started thinking of it as a franchise instead of as a platform to tell great stories, they were doomed. So I think you need a producer who is willing to go to the mattresses and say, "Look, what Star Trek is about is about exploring new frontiers, not just out there in space, but ideas for humanity as well." And without that, it's not Star Trek. It's just a space show. So I would hope that there's a producer who's willing to speak truth to power. Otherwise, he's just a guy who's there to collect a paycheck every week, and we know how that works out. I've seen that with not just Star Trek, but with other shows.
You know, it's interesting. My spousal equivalent is a big science fiction fan, but isn't intimately familiar with the original series like I am. And so we've been watching episodes on Hulu and getting her caught up. And we watched A Taste of Armageddon, which at that point was a Vietnam allegory, what with the body
Taste
counts.
Of Armageddon is about mutual assured destruction, if I remember correctly.
Right. And the idea that they've sanitized it, the Vendicans and Armenians had sanitized it because that's the only way for the culture to continue. And of course, Kirk throws the monkey wrench into that. But I'm watching it, and I realize that it's applicable in some ways to today with drone warfare. We want to avoid putting our people in harm's way. So if we can just send machines to do a man's job, then let's do that. But like they found in that particular story, the problem is that you don't want to put your people in harm's way. You just don't want to have a war in the first place.
Well,
and
yeah.
It's that disconnect.
That's actually, I would argue that one. There are a lot of people who want to have a war. They just want the other guy to die. It's because war is about hurting the other guy. And people who want to go to war don't ever stop to think, what will the pain be here at home? What will my pain be? What will the pain be for the home front? And what we know from our own history is that even when we win a war, we still lose because the money we spent on that war is money that we did not spend on education, infrastructure, health care, all the things that make us a great nation. When we spend it on war, we're not spending it on ourselves. We're not spending it on our children. We're not spending it on the stuff that make us great. So there's a story that should be told, is what's the real cost of winning a war? Eisenhower said it, that every dollar spent on bombs is a dollar not spent on books.
It's funny you say that, because that's what I thought and hoped Deep Space Nine was going to be.
Deep Space Nine was one of the better spin-offs because it was off in its own place without a lot of the same kind of tight supervision that some of the other shows were getting. And they took chances. I think Deep Space Nine was the episode I haven't seen it all, but the episodes I saw, I thought turned out very well.
Excellent. So we will keep everyone up to date on all of the Star Trek anniversary happenings. Are you attending any of the conventions?
Well, I haven't. I don't have plans to go to Vegas Creation Con this year. I'm tentatively scheduled. It hasn't been confirmed yet to go to the big celebration in New York in September, but I haven't heard any details about that yet. And those are the only two that nobody else has said, gee, you know, we ought to invite the guy who wrote the Tribble script, too. So,
well, that's a shame.
Which is just as well, because every trip costs me writing time. And I would love to go to some of these big parties that are planned. I hope some of the people will remember me. I hope they'll also remember Dorothy Fontana and Harlan Ellison and some of the other people who worked behind the scenes, too, who are still with us. Because the show wasn't just the actors. The show was a lot of the success was the skill and the dedication of people who weren't in front of the camera.
Yes, you had Gene's vision, and then you had the writers that he brought in to make the stories that made that vision happen.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Gene, at his best, Gene was a genuine visionary, the likes of which television has rarely seen.
Well, Boarding the Enterprise, the updated anniversary edition, is available in bookstores, and Slice of Sci-Fi actually has a couple copies to give away. So if you head on over to sliceofscifi.com and enter the contest, maybe you'll win a copy. Hopefully, By the time we send out our prize copies, David will have his own copy.
The cover looks great. I've seen the cover, but I don't actually have a copy of the book yet.
Excellent. Well, thank you for your time today, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
Thank you very much.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Welcome to Tales of the Black Badge, a Wynonna Earp fan podcast. WynonnaEarpPodcast.com. Thanks again for checking in, and I hope you all take care. I told that devil
to take you back. Tales of the Black Badge, presented by Tuning Into Sci-Fi TV.
Hello and hi. Welcome back to even more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm your host, Summer Brooks, and my guest right now is multi-award-winning science fiction author Robert J. Sawyer. He's won Hugo, a Nebula, Aurora, and a whole lot of awards that are just too long to list right now. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Well, thank you. You know, you make me think of Samuel T. Coghlan, since we're going to talk about Star Trek here, when they're reading Captain Kirk's record in the episode Court Martial. Nice. And the prosecutor says, we waive the reading of the captain's estimable record. And Coghlan says, well, I certainly don't want to slow down the wheels of progress. However, I would not want them also to run over my client in their unbridled haste. But I agree with you in this circumstance. We don't have to list all the awards, although I'm lucky enough to have actually won a passel of them, 55 at last count for
Holy
my
cow.
Science fiction work. So I'm very, very proud of what I do within the science fiction field. But we're talking today about me as more as fan than anything, because David Gerald and I put together a book. David worked on Star Trek. I just grew up with Star Trek. But both of us obviously love the show a great deal, and we have a 10th anniversary edition of our book, Boarding the Enterprise, just
yes.
out from Ben Bella Books, in honor of our 10th anniversary of the book, 50th anniversary of classic Star Trek. And that's, I think, the principal reason we're talking today.
Yes, the book just came out this week, which, for some reason, May is starting everybody's ramp up of the 50th anniversary of all things Trek. I believe the official Star Trek convention where the big parties are happening is going to be in August. Is that correct?
And I shall be there, the 50th anniversary Star Trek convention in Las Vegas. They're also doing, for the first time in many years, one in New York as well. But the longest running and largest Star Trek convention has been the Creation Con in Las Vegas. And I've gone the last several years and will certainly be there this year, in part to celebrate Boarding the Enterprise, but mostly to just celebrate this five decades, half century, of one of the very few optimistic science fiction franchises, something that doesn't have war or battle in its title. And I'm very, very grateful to be part of that.
So how did the original Boarding the Enterprise come about? Because it's a little different from some of the other entries in the Smart Pop series, where they got as many people involved directly with Star Trek as possible to contribute to it.
They, meaning we, me and
yes,
David. Yes,
you and David, right.
So before there even was this Smart Pop line, which is Ben Bella's line of books about popular culture with commentary on popular culture, on Buffy or Battlestar Galactica, what have you, their very first, or one of their very first books that they did testing the waters in that area, was called Taking the Red Pill.
Yes.
And it was a book of essays about The Matrix. And mm-hmm. it did phenomenally well. And I wrote an essay that Glenn Yeffeth, the editor at Ben Bella, publisher at Ben Bella, liked very much. And so he started coming to me, or his staff started coming to me with, would you like to write about this show? Would you like to write about that show? And I finally said, Glenn, all of that is fine. But what I really want to do is a book about Star Trek. And we were looking for a way to make it distinguished in a crowded marketplace, because, of mm-hmm. course, there are literally hundreds of books about Star Trek. And David Gerald and I have been friends since the 1980s. going back to an online friendship on CompuServe.
Wow.
An old online service. And so, I brought it to David's attention, and David was already having his backlist published by Ben Bella. And, boom, the deal was done. It was literally hours from me suggesting it to Glenn to us having me and David on board to do this book. And, of course, David knew D.C. Fontana, and David and I both knew Norman Spinrad, and I knew Larry Niven, and David had collaborated with Larry, and so on and so forth. So we were immediately able to gather some of the big names associated with writing for the actual series. And of course, David himself, who wrote The Trouble with Tribbles, regarded by many as the most popular episode in the entire franchise. And I was coming at it from a different place. I'm coming at it as a science fiction writer who very much got into the business because of my appreciation for Star Trek. Star Trek really was what hooked me. Mm-hmm. I did see episodes in first run. I did see the very first one I saw was Devil in the Dark when it first aired in 1967 when I was 7 years old. But it was really when it was being saturation in syndication, 5 nights a week, sometimes multiple episodes a day on different channels in the early 70s that I became immersed in it. And I wasn't the only one of modern science fiction writers. There were people like Alan Steele and Paul Levinson, who also really fell in love with the show, Lawrence Watt Evans, at that period. And I thought, that's the counterbalance. How did it influence a whole generation of science fiction writers? We've got some people who wrote for the show. They can tell us what they were trying to accomplish. The other half is, what impact did it have on the whole field of science fiction? And so it is a different kind of book for Ben Bella, and one that David and I are very, very proud of, and so pleased that it's part of these half-century celebrations now.
Yeah, just the perspective of so many acclaimed science fiction writers who say, yeah, Star Trek was my gateway drug. It led me to where I am now. Just seeing that perspective, getting a feel for that influence, and from so many different perspectives and walks of life, is just one show that cut across an entire spectrum of a society, of a world, actually now. It's just boggling.
Well, absolutely, I agree. And Roddenberry was trying to sell the first adult science fiction series. Came out in 1966. And I was actually just at a science fiction convention in Toronto where we did a panel discussion on 1966, the year of science fiction on TV. There was more primetime science fiction that year than any other year in terms of network television shows. There was Lost in Space. There was The Time Tunnel. There was Star Trek. There was the original Batman with Adam West, which certainly had its science fictional elements. And on and on and on. And it stood out. You can go back and I could watch Star Trek as a 7-year-old boy, which is when I first saw Devil in the Dark. And I can watch it as a 56-year-old man and still take great pleasure in it. I think my taste in episodes may have shifted a bit over the decades, but a show that can capture the imagination of a kid and still be nutritive for an intellectual, for a person of, who's read a lot, who knows a lot, who's been around the world. Lost in Space can't do that. There's nothing for an adult in Lost in Space. There's zero. I'm sorry, there just is zero. And Time Tunnel really doesn't hold up at all either. But Star Trek endures because of the quality of the writing. The quality of the acting, certainly, quality of everything, but the quality of the writing more than anything else made it completely different, and that's why it's endured so long.
What do you think was, just personally speaking, since you were one of the editors of the volume, what was the essay that had the most impact or most surprising perspective for you?
We had some great ones, but I was a huge, there's one guy I wanted for this book and went after him and got him. His name is Eric Green. Yes. With an E at the end and Eric with a C, best known for doing the most insightful, intelligent analysis of the Planet of the Apes films, the original films and the TV show, has a book called Planet of the Apes as American Myth. Still in print, wonderful book. And I'd read that before I'd ever met Eric. Subsequently, I sought him out and we became great and fast friends. But the guy was so penetratively insightful about what Planet of the Apes was really talking about: race relations, fear of nuclear war, all sorts of stuff that was very trenchant commentary about the things that were going on in American society as those films were being made. And I wanted him to do the same thing for Star Trek. And he did it for us. And he wrote a magnificent essay. First among equals, I'll say. All the contributions are good. David and I really, you know, we're hands-on editors. And we sent people back when we needed revisions. And we didn't take everything that was offered to us for the book. But Eric's is the one that I went after and was so pleased to get. It's an extremely thoughtful essay. In fact, just today, just this afternoon, I was contacted because somebody saw a notice on my Facebook wall. This book is out. It's, oh, I'm teaching a course about Star Trek this fall. I've been asked to put one together. Would your book be useful as a text? And I said, absolutely. We've got this Eric Green essay. We've got this essay by Michael Burstein about religion in science fiction. We've got religion in Star Trek. We've got Dr. Paul Levinson, communications professor, Fordham University, doing a really interesting analysis of how Star Trek, the 79 jewels, as they were called, the 79 syndicated episodes, completely remaked our modern view of television, of how you experience television. You know, we wouldn't have been binge watching today if it hadn't been for the syndication of five Star Treks in a week. Back in the 70s, and it's a really interesting analysis. So there's so much meat on the bones in the essays in this book, but those are three that stand out immediately in my mind.
That is so amazing that you mentioned that Eric Green essay, because that's the essay Ben Bella sent me to excerpt for the blog tour this week.
Oh, did they? Oh, yeah. Well, then clearly their taste equals mine in this. Eric has gone on since this. He's gone on to do some other essays for Ben Bella. I'm very proud of the fact that I was sort of that I was the discoverer of Eric for this kind of work. And Ben Bella has made good use of him since, because he is such an insightful commentator. Used to be a lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union, now works as the diversity person at University of Southern California. Just a fascinating guy.
Excellent. That was, like I said, you never know who could be a science fiction fan, a Star Trek fan, a Star Wars fan, whose life has been influenced by that, and what opinions they have about the world around them that might have been influenced by being a fan of something like that. So it's always, to me, enlightening and a little bit enriching to find commentary like that. Because you never know. It's like, we were like, whoa, I never thought of that before. Wow. Okay. Cool.
You know, my doctor for many years had a framed poster in the lobby of her practice that said, everything I needed to know in life I learned from Star Trek. And it just had a whole series of aphorisms and witticisms taken from lines of dialogue from the series. Most significantly, of course, live long and prosper. But there's an enormous amount of wit and wisdom in Star Trek that really provides interesting life lessons. And it is doctors and lawyers and engineers and scientists and school teachers and lots of clergy and very interesting people who have found this an engaging show over the decades. And you just don't find it many shows that cut across that broadly across society. There's a great picture, I'm sure you've seen it, of President Obama greeting Nichelle Nichols in the Oval Office, and they're both doing the Vulcan salute. There's a picture recently of my prime minister, I live in Canada, Justin Trudeau, our new prime minister, mourning the death of Leonard Nimoy a year ago now, but doing the Vulcan salute. I mean, these are world leaders, particularly Obama, obviously, who are really into this. That's an astonishing thing. And we can all hope that the vision of a positive tomorrow is something our world leaders are taking very, very seriously.
Now, what in this book or in related to Star Trek in general would you suggest or recommend for people who are fans of science fiction but have never really managed to fully get on that Star Trek train as a lot of diehard fans are?
You know, Star Trek is a big amorphous thing now because there are five television series plus the animated series plus the original movies, the Next Gen movies, the J.J. Abrams universe movies. And I say, forget everything but the original 79 episodes. Even forget the Star Trek movies. Star Trek, starting with Nicholas Meyer and The Wrath of Khan, Star Trek took a turn towards the more militaristic, the darker, the more action-adventure. It was competing, it felt, instead of being an alternative to Star Wars. But the original episodes, with the social commentary they were doing and just the high level of writing, I said, go and get the DVDs or the magnificent-looking Blu-rays and give it a try. And, you know, if you're used to the high level of special effects, and yes, they're brilliant in the J.J. Abrams and in the later series, give yourself 15 minutes. Trust me. Go and watch an episode like City on the Edge of Forever. Go and watch an episode like The Doomsday Machine, my favorite, Requiem for Methuselah, which I didn't much care for at all as a kid, but adore as a middle-aged man. Incredible retelling of Shakespeare's The Tempest in a science fiction setting. Go and watch The Conscience of the King about the mass murderer Kodos, the executioner, and just revel in how poignant the stories are and how good the acting is.
Okay, we'll make some notes. Leave a few there for some of our fans to comment on and investigate, because that's what science fiction is all about, continuing to look for things to explore and discover.
Yes, exactly. And the thing about Star Trek, the original series, Gene Roddenberry said, here's one of the many ways in which he sold it, is that, you know, there were science fiction anthology series, Outer Limits, The Twilight Zone, for instance, that existed prior to Star Trek. Mm-hmm. They were expensive to produce because every week you needed new sets. You had to hire new guest stars, right? And he said, you know, if you had a format where you had people going from world to world every week, you could use the same standing sets and the same recurring cast and still tell an anthology series. And the subsequent shows weren't nearly as much like that. The difference between one classic Star Trek episode and the next is often night and day. Now, I spent a lot of time in Hollywood. I had a series, Flash Forward, on ABC. And I know what Hollywood looks for today, and they look for sameness of tone. They look for predictability. What are you going to deliver every week? Is it going to be dark every week? Is it going to be dark? Is it going to be light every week? Is it going to be light? That's not Star Trek. Star Trek is The Trouble with Tribbles, incredibly lightweight stuff, the one that David wrote. Star Trek is City on the Edge of Forever, incredibly heart-wrenching stuff. Star Trek is Let That Be Your Last Battlefield, with the half-black, half-white characters doing arguably quite over the top, but very effective social commentary.
Right.
Star Trek is action adventure, like The Doomsday Machine that Norman Spinrad, one of the authors we have in Boarding the Enterprise, wrote. Star Trek is just incredible family drama, like Journey to Babel, which another one of our authors, DC Fontana, wrote. You don't get that variety in any of the subsequent series. You just don't. Mm. Nobody makes television like that anymore, where you literally, you know, it's the Forrest Gump theory of television. It should be like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get next. That's what Star Trek was, the original series. Nobody has equaled that since in terms of providing a real mix of episodes. Indeed, there have been a whole season-long arcs in Enterprise and Deep Space Nine, where it's essentially one big story, and you come in at any point in the season, you get more of the same. Okay, oh, they're still fighting the Dominion. I'll check back in a few months and see how it's going, right? Star Trek, you miss one week, you miss a strange new world. You miss new life. You miss new civilizations. You miss boldly going every week if you missed a single week.
Now, there are a handful of Star Trek related documentaries out there. Which ones have intrigued and impressed you about digging deeper into what Star Trek is?
Well, it's kind of interesting, given what I just said. There's a great one just out well, it's out almost a year ago now, that William Shatner did.
Chaos on the Bridge.
Called Chaos on the Bridge, about what went wrong with Star Trek The Next Generation, particularly in the first year. And I've always been fascinated, you know, because between 69, when Star Trek The Original Series went off, and 87, when Next Generation started, 18 years. Mm-hmm. During those 18 years, yes, there was Star Trek The Motion Picture and some of the sequels. But during those 18 years, and particularly the first decade, Gene Roddenberry went around to college campuses. That's how he made his living. Get a speaking fee. College, university campuses. Other cast members did too. James Doohan came to Toronto. I remember seeing him, University of Toronto. Maybe they would bring the blooper reel, and maybe they would, you know, show an episode or whatever. But Gene kept telling the story over and over again about what he thought Star Trek was. And he came up with this vision of it that actually wasn't what he'd put on film. And it drifted away into this very utopian. Gene had become a practicing Buddhist. It would be a very utopian, peaceful version. And when he went to make Star Trek The Next Generation, he literally, I think, had lost touch with what made the original Star Trek work so well. And Shatner was curious about this. He never watched Next Gen. As he says, he didn't even watch the original series. Hates watching himself on camera. But he got curious about this. And enough time has passed, and enough of the people who were angry have passed away, that those who were still with us spoke extremely candidly in that documentary to Shatner, who is a really good interviewer, you know. I mean, he had his interview series, Raw Nerve. He's really good at it. He knows when to shut up and listen. He doesn't have to hog the stage. And when somebody is on the verge of making a confession or revealing a secret, Shatner knows to let them go ahead and get to it. So that's the one that I thought was the most interesting of all of late. And I'm sure there are going to be lots more concentrating on the original series for the 50th anniversary.
I hope so, because that, like I say, when Chaos on the Bridge came out, we got an advanced look at it like about a month before it was released. And it was the most compelling, fascinating thing I had ever heard. I'm like, this is what behind the scenes talk about classic TV shows should be.
Yes, so much behind the scenes talk is fluff to sell the show, or is nostalgia, or is just nobody remembers, right? Oh yeah, see that guy? Yeah, I remember, we used to work together, right? And this was really penetrating, really penetrating. Now, there will be, I can't tell you who's doing it, but I was just interviewed for a documentary for the 50th anniversary, and the people who were going in and out as I was coming in and out to do my own interview for it, it's going to be an amazing piece when it gets released. I'll say that as a teaser.
That's a hell of a teaser.
Mm-hmm,
hopefully,
yes.
I'm guessing it'll be released around the time of the convention.
It'll be certainly out in time for the anniversary at the beginning of September.
Excellent, excellent. Well, when you can tell us about it, feel free to shoot me an email and we'll
sure.
let people know. But thank you for your insights and your memories, your remembrances of Star Trek.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. It's just a thrill to have Boarding the Enterprise out in a new edition for this 50th anniversary, because I didn't discover Star Trek until 67, so it's 49 years for me. But my whole life, in essence, has been as a Trekkie, Trekker, Trek fanatic, Trek fan, Trek lover. And to be able to have a physical artifact, this book, which also available as an ebook, but a physical artifact that commemorates that half century of love that I felt, that David felt, that all of our contributors felt. It just, I'm so proud of it. Boarding the Enterprise is, you know, I've got 23 novels of my own, but this is one of the books I'm proudest of.
That's Boarding the Enterprise, Transporters, Tribbles, and the Vulcan Death Grip in Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek, edited by the inestimable Robert J. Soar and the inestimable David Gerrold, is available in bookstores now, on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, wherever you choose to do your physical book buying. And it's also available in an ebook version?
Ebook for all your standard platforms. Kindle, Kobo, Nook, whatever you have, iBooks, it's there. By all means, go and get a copy.
Yeah. And we'll have links to the book there and links to Robert's site and also the essay by Eric Green, The Prime Question, I believe is the name of it.
Yes.
There's an excerpt of it right here on the website, sliceofscifi.com. Again, thank you for your time today, Robert.
My absolute pleasure, Summer. Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi.
Hey, you. Stop hiding behind that sofa. Come out from back there. Your sofa wants to talk to you. Wants to play footsie with your mind. Listen to it. Relax. Let it in. Starship Sofa. The first podcast ever to win a Hugo Award. With weekly stories from the world's best authors. Michael Moorcock, Peter Watts, Joe Haldeman, Peter F. Hamilton, and many, many, many more. With news and reviews and interviews. Bradbury, Pole, Wolfe, and Mieville, the sofas chewed the fat with them all. Facts and fictions, articles and particles. Oh, why aren't you listening? StarshipSofa.com. Your best science fictional fix this side of the coffee table.
While I am not personally as big a fan of Star Trek as so many others are, I did enjoy some episodes of some of the series. I mean, I was one of the people who watched Next Generation because there was no other sci-fi on TV at the time. The original series, except for a handful of episodes, I don't know, maybe I'm not patient enough. Maybe I was never patient enough before to try to get into it. I may try to get into it again. I don't know. But there's no denying the impact on science fiction television, on science fiction writers, on science fiction marketing that Star Trek has had 50 years. The shift from what do we do with this thing to, oh my God, how can we make more money off this thing has been very evident over the years from Paramount, CBS, whatever other acronyms are in that conglomeration. And for time reasons, the conversation about Axanar never came up. I know. Maybe we'll have one later. I don't know. I don't know who can even talk about what's going on there or even if they would, if they could. So maybe after the dust settles, we'll be able to talk to some people about what's going on there. But in any event, talking with both Rob Sawyer and David Gerald was a delight because you've got two guys who are acclaimed science fiction authors, both multi-award winners, Hugos, Nebulas, you name it. And one wrote for Star Trek, one was influenced to start writing science fiction because of Star Trek. And knowing that they are part of a historical link that connects old school sci-fi with a whole generation of science fiction writers who they themselves have inspired a new generation of science fiction writers, all of whom are trying their best, working very hard to boldly go where only their minds can take us. How can you not appreciate that? I appreciate it, even though I'm not as big a fan of the series, the franchise, as a lot of other people around here are, and let's just say that the divergent opinions make for delicious discussions every now and then. But that'll do it for this episode. If you have your own questions or comments, call them in. The number is 602-635-6976. Or you can record a message of your own and email that to summer@sliceofscifi.com. Or just email me a comment yourself. You know, it doesn't have to be recorded. Just question, comment, ask away. I will say that I'm working on putting together a series of essays, articles, opinions, commentaries from various contributors from as broad a fan base as I can find. If you're a fan of Star Trek, I think you will enjoy the opinions and observations that these folks will have. And those will be coming up in the next few months on the website, sliceofscifi.com. So keep checking back and keep up with all the other stuff that we are covering here at Slice of Sci-Fi. If you listen to the show on iTunes, leave us a review. You can also check us out on Stitcher and TuneIn. And yes, Google Play hopefully is imminent. Check us out on Twitter at Slice of Sci-Fi, at Slice of Sci-Fi TV. The most recent video Noah and Darren have done is a compare and contrast between the success of Captain America's Civil War and the disappointment of X-Men Apocalypse, which I think everybody else will get to see next week. Check us out on Google Plus, Slice of Sci-Fi there. We do have a Facebook page. It is still active. I have no access to it. But if you want to start your own Star Trek 50th anniversary comment thread over there, I think you can. The websites, sliceofscifi.com, writersafterdark.com, kickassmysticninjas.com, popculturegeeks.com. A lot of different entertainment options for you there. And yes, we are working on more ninjas. Yes, there will be ninjas. I'm not going to tell you when. We're ninjas. We sneak up on you like that. Thank you, everybody, for your donations and your patronage over at patreon.com. Every dime that is donated goes to support the hosting of these websites, the hosting of the shows. Yes, even paying for the hosting of the Babylon Podcast back catalog, the Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas back catalog, even the back catalog for older shows like Charlie Jade and Voices of Babylon, and yeah, even the Wingin' Its. Those are still out there for you to browse in iTunes or download, and all of the money that comes in from donations and pledges goes to help keep that online. So I am very grateful to everyone for helping me keep all of this stuff online for all of us, because I enjoy creating this content, and I really do hope that everybody who's listening enjoys hearing or reading all of this content. If you want to help support, you can go over to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/sliceofscifi. Pledge any amount, $5 a month, $1 a month. It all helps, trust me. And again, my enduring thanks to everyone who is currently donating, either via Patreon or PayPal. As always, my never-ending gratitude goes out to Sci-Fried for the wonderful job they did with our theme music. If you like your geek music rock-flavored, go check them out. They're over at sci-friedband.com. They have some free samples over there. They have some awesome albums over there. I highly recommend 5 because the song Hulk Smash just warms my heart. It's an awesome, awesome song. And I believe Ramming Speed is the album that has the Babylon 5 parody For Whom Babylon Tolls. Oh, sorry, the Metallica parody, For Whom Babylon Tolls, which is another awesome cover. But that'll do it right now. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi. Next week's Memorial Day, I don't know if I'm going to do a show for next weekend or just skip over to June, give myself a break. So there might be another Slice of Sci-Fi next week or not. Either way, thanks so much for listening and take care.